We're glad you're joining us here at NRCC Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts.
So, our lesson this summer, how to change the world. Part one, change your brain. Part two, change your relationships. Part three, change your relationship to power, or don't give your power away. Today, we finish up the introductory part of the lesson that we began last week, some groundwork, some context, and I want to do that by thinking about how to approach changing the world. Two approaches commonly taken, both are good, both are important. One is service work, and the other is systems work. Serving needs and working on the systems that create the needs in the first place. And again, both are very important. Jesus was very clear about service needs. He said, when someone's thirsty, give them a drink. When someone's hungry, give them food. Someone's cold, give them a coat. But also, Jesus taught systems work. If you grew up in Sunday school, you might not fully understand one of Jesus' most central points. It's wrapped up in a term that he used a lot. The term is the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. When Jesus used that phrase, what he was talking about was changing systems. It's not uncommon for church folk to misunderstand that term, the kingdom of God, because many of us were taught that it's about the afterlife, where our souls will go when we die. But as I've taught in other contexts, when we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found a Rosetta Stone of sorts. Is a genre of literature that we didn't understand previously. It's called Jewish apocalyptic literature. And it turns out that the texts that we refer to when we are formulating our thoughts about the end of time or the afterlife weren't written about the end of time or the afterlife. Those who were writing those texts were writing about some current season of oppression they were undergoing. They were writing about their longing to be free from that oppression and for God to deliver them from this oppressor or that oppressor. It was about a longing for self-determination because geographically where they were located, they were right at the crossroads of anybody going anywhere to take land away from somebody else. And so often it happened through their history that they didn't have self-determination, and this genre of literature developed as a way to talk about that deep longing. Looking for self-determination, they wanted to be able to return to a society that was founded on what they believed was a divine code, the code given them, given us, by Moses. Now, I mentioned last week the Mosaic Law Code. It outlined a society that was designed for the well-being of all, not just for the well-being of some. It was a system of laws like regular recurring land reform so that every generation could get a fresh start, so that there would be no permanent classes, multi-generational classes of rich people or multi-generational classes of poor people. The Mosaic Code was a set of laws designed to take care of those who fell through the cracks in any one of those generations, laws that would protect people when it didn't go well for weather reasons or for personal capacity reasons. Whatever was the reason, there were laws in place to protect those who fell through the cracks. So there was embedded in the code a built-in social safety net. Laws allowed one to sell one's land or even sell one's self and one's family into a kind of indentured servitude and in so doing be able to stay alive, to have food, to have shelter, to have clothing, and to have a family who would also have food and shelter and clothing to be able to survive that generation. But those same laws prohibited indentured servitude becoming a permanent arrangement. Permanent slavery was disallowed. Permanent sharecropping, which was that arrangement when one sold oneself, was into a sharecropping arrangement. That permanency was not allowed. These things were only allowed for a limited time. Wealth and poverty were not to be intergenerational. Land and freedom went through a reset every 49 years. People were brought out of servitude every 49 years. Land was returned every 49 years. Debts were forgiven every 49 years, and the slate was wiped clean. But every time a foreign oppressor took over, that holistic system, it went out the window. And in its place came a permanent land ownership system. Now, land at the time was the currency of wealth. That's how you knew you were wealthy, as you had land. Currency was not as big a deal. So as soon as one of these oppressors came in, that whole idea of returning things went out the window, and instead permanency was given to those who would collaborate with the occupying force, and those people were given permanent access to land. So in Jesus' time, it was the Romans who had been pushing out the Mosaic Code. It was the Romans who were creating a permanent landed class, a collaborator class. And it was the Romans who were pushing Israel into a permanent state of haves and have-nots. And so when you hear Jesus talking about the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven, when you hear Jesus telling stories about tax collectors or telling stories about stewards, and goodness sake, there are a lot of those, he was talking about restoring this divine way to a society in how they functioned together. That they were to function for the well-being of the whole, not just for the well-being of the part. And so when Jesus used that term, he was advocating systems change, restoring the Mosaic safety net, abolishing permanent classes of sharecroppers, abolishing a permanent ruling class. So of course, Jesus taught, when someone is being hurt under these Roman systems, feed them and clothe them. Give them a drink. Visit them when they're in prison. Of course, we do that. But that's only part of the equation. He was calling for a people who would work on changing the systems that were overtaking them, a people who would work on returning this compassionate system that cared for all. Now, what he wasn't saying was doing it the way the zealots thought we should do it. The zealots thought we should do it by going out and slicing some Roman throats. And if we did that, well, then God would come to our aid and we would rise and overthrow the people. He wasn't advocating we do what the zealots were advocating we do, because that was, he said, if you live by the sword, you're just going to end up dying by the sword. And he also wasn't advocating we do it the way the Herodians said we should do it. And what they said that we should do is that we should get super pure in our religious practice. And if we got super pure, we followed all the laws and we did them exactly the way they were written down. We even tithed down to the grains that we harvested in the field, and we counted out 10% of those. If we did everything the way we were supposed to do it, well, then God would come to our aid, and then we'd be able to throw off the oppressors. And Jesus was saying, yeah, neither of those are going to work. If they were going to work, they would have worked by now. What he was saying is there is another way, and it is the way of love. It is the way of understanding the depth of what love means. Not this syrupy idea of love, but the way of building relationship across lines that divide us. So he was saying we've got to work on systems, changing systems, reinstituting the divine way. So Jesus taught both service and systems. And if we follow Jesus, that's us. Serving those who've been hurt by the systems, working to change the systems themselves. But even though that was a central theme for Jesus, it's a notion that a lot of folks in church are uncomfortable with. Because we've been taught, or we've taught ourselves, that we ought to stay in our lane. We ought to stay in our spiritual lane, our religious lane. And we ought to leave economics, and we ought to leave politics, and we ought to leave culture in their lanes. But if we're going to take Jesus seriously and understand him in the historical context in which he taught, economics is spirituality, and culture is spirituality. The big picture, the systems that create the society, these are just as important as compassion toward the person who was right in front of us, who was hurting. Now, here's the thing. Economics and culture and politics, they are all ways that together we say our collective yeses and we say our collective noes. Collectively, we make decisions all the time. Shall we build a hospital on this land or shall we build a train station? Shall we use this empty lot for a playground or shall we use it for a highway? And we make those decisions on the basis of, one, who's at the table when the decision gets made, and two, what are the values and the priorities of the people who are at the table when the decision is made? And those values and those priorities are going to focus on the good of the whole or the good of the part, the good of me and mine or the good of everybody. Our values are going to be shaped by either spiritual maturity or spiritual immaturity. The collective choices that we make, our economic choices, our cultural choices, and our political choices, are going to be made according to a set of values. And there is not much that is more spiritual than that. Jesus said more about our economic choices than he said about anything. When we say yes, or when we say no, there is a spirituality that informs that decision. And the question is it a healthy spirituality or no? And spirituality, that is our lane. So when people tell us, or when we tell ourselves, whoa, that's politics, that's economics, that's culture, come on, church, stay in your lane, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the whole point of religion and the whole point of spirituality. And it's a fundamentalist misunderstanding of the teaching of Jesus. Now, I've said these kinds of things before, so I know from experience that I've already bothered some people. I've already made some folks really uncomfortable. That happens when we move past our Sunday school understanding of Jesus. When we position Jesus and what Jesus taught in the cultural context of his day, it makes us uncomfortable. Now, some of that discomfort surfaces because systems change just seems way, way too big. It could feel like Jesus is assigning us something that we can't possibly imagine being able to do. And that makes us uncomfortable. And if that's you, hold on, because I think this lesson is going to help. It's going to be one more iteration of here now, small, doable. We're going to be able to do it. But the other discomfort is probably more acute these days. Oh, God, no, he's talking about politics. That discomfort. Because anybody with a lick of sense, especially in recent times, doesn't talk about that. Especially not in church where we're trying to build community. You just heard it in the announcements. We're working on extending belonging and connecting and all of that stuff. And now you're going to bring this into it? Come on, what are you doing? Because we all know that we don't all agree on ideology. We don't agree on political ideology, we don't agree on cultural norms, and we don't agree on economic ideology. And we sure don't want to talk about our personal money because that's way, way too private and that's going to really push too far. So Doug, come on, what are you doing? Here's what you're doing, Doug. You're just inviting division. And many of us are still stinging from the last go-round. We did live through that election, we did. We lost friends. Some of us even lost family. So, yeah, it's okay to talk in very big picture terms about changing the world. But when it gets practical, it is not going to end well. That's why, Doug, politics and economics and social policy, they just don't belong in church. Ideology and church, they just don't mix. Community of communities, oh, that sounds nice. Sure, we can do that. Potlucks across the divide, okay, we'll do that. Listening circles, storytelling, sure, that's all well and good. But here's what's going to happen, Doug. Somebody's going to start pushing some issue, and it's going to be an issue I don't agree with. It's going to be based on some ideology that I don't share. So what now? Are we just going to break relationship again? Or is somebody going to start pushing that issue and make me, force me, pressure me to conform or to agree? Or am I going to be shamed or blamed? Because that's what happened last time, and it was really ugly. Systems change? Yeah, I don't think we can get there from here. Let's just focus on service. We can do that. Let's make sandwiches for homeless people. We can do that. Well, if that's you, I would also encourage you to hang in there, because I think this lesson will give us a roadmap for how to get out of that box canyon. But because I know that that objection is particularly acute in our society at this moment in time, I'd like to jump ahead to kind of a point coming in a later, less part of the lesson and tell a quick story, and maybe that story will give us some hope. So in Durham, this community of communities that we're forming right now, this IAF organization, they started it 20 years ago. And so they've been going for a while. And they started the building the relationships like we're doing now. They started it way back then. They started building relationship across the lines that typically divide people, listening to one another, what causes pressure on you, what are the pains that you feel living in our city, hearing stories, telling stories. And then they started working on things together collectively, the things that we're planning to do. At one of the meetings that I attended, two ministers from Durham came to tell their story. They had just then come off of a victory that had to do with some properties in Durham and how they were going to be used, what kind of housing was going to go there. The city had some unused land that they were going to sell. Durham was and is experiencing the same kind of skyrocketing land and housing prices that Raleigh is. So when that land was coming available from the city, there were contractors lined up 10 deep to pay the city top dollar in order to buy that property and build high-end housing. But as they'd been telling stories in their community of communities, they were realizing that what was happening is that their people in their congregations were being pushed out of the city because they couldn't afford to live there. Many people working full-time at minimum wage could not find a single apartment in the city that they could afford. They certainly couldn't afford to buy a home in the city. So these congregations all recognize this is a pressure we are feeling, this is a pain our people are feeling. And they got together, told their stories, shared their pressure, figured out that that's what they wanted to work on together, and then they went to work, and they created a change. And they got the city to sell those properties to create a place of affordable housing in the city of Durham. And so right after this victory that they had experienced together, these two ministers came to tell a gathering of folks who were thinking about starting this kind of organization in Wake County, tell their story. One of them was a black evangelical Pentecostal preacher, and the other was some kind of a liberal white minister. I don't remember if it was Methodist or Unitarian or something like that. And they told their story. And after they told the story of what had happened, one of the people in the group asked the Pentecostal guy, so how do you work with these people? The subtext of the question was, anybody who knows anything about church knows that you two don't mix. Your groups don't get together. And so the minister was quiet for a moment, and then he said, standing next to the liberal white guy who was sitting down, he said with clear affection in his tone, he said, I know that we don't agree on gay marriage, and I know that we don't agree on HB2. I know we don't agree on abortion. We don't agree on politics. We don't agree on a lot of things. But we know that. He said, but we also know that we're not going to change each other's minds, and so we're kind of not making that the point of our relationship together. He said, but knowing that in the past has been like a line that we couldn't cross, and we segregated ourselves according to whether we agreed on these issues or didn't agree on these issues, and that disagreement being a line we couldn't cross meant that we couldn't work together, even on things that we could agree on, like the pressure our families are facing around housing. But here's the thing, he said. If we're going to change systems, if we're going to change the things that make people homeless, or the things that drive people too far away from the city to be able to even get jobs, if we're going to change that stuff, we can't just work with people who agree with us, because there aren't enough of them. And if we do that, we're never going to change systems. But when we learn this basic principle Jesus taught us of being able to love one another, even with our differences, then we can work together. And then he sat down, and then the liberal white guy stood up and picked up the story. And he said, our church worked hard advocating for gay marriage in our state. Our church worked hard advocating against HB2. But he said, in all those efforts, all the things that we've done to work together, I know I would never ask him or their congregation to be involved in that work. Because we've developed enough of a relationship with one another that I know that their conviction on this issue runs just as deeply as our conviction runs on this issue. Their congregation would be betraying a deep belief if they worked for gay marriage, just like our congregation would be betraying a deep belief if we didn't work on that. And he said, I've come to love him, and I've come to respect him, and so we don't work together on that issue. And we don't fight with each other about what we think about that issue. Once in a while, he said, in a very amenable way, we talk about it because we've gotten to know each other. And I will tell him the deep why that drives us to do what we do. And he'll tell me the deep why that drives him to do what we do. And he said, but I haven't persuaded him yet. And he hasn't persuaded me. And then he smiled. He said, you did hear that yet. The other guy smiled too. Now, it is an observable thing when you know about churches that lots of churches only work on service work. Because Jesus said it's important, and also systems work is so much harder. Which is why the next part of the lesson is about becoming the kind of people who can actually work on systems change. To be those kind of people, we have to be much bigger of heart. To be those kind of people, we cannot be tribal. We cannot be exclusionist. We cannot be sectarian. We can't make judging the other our primary relationship to the other. We can't make dividing from the other our primary go-to response once we figure out we don't agree. We have to become the kind of people who can live and work in that arena. And that requires some change in our brains. Because here's what has been habituated in our society. And it's been especially habituated in the church. In the last 500 years, we've read the Bible looking for the way of God. And when we found it, and then found someone else who found a different way of God, we couldn't go to church together. And so we had to split from one another, and we went from two denominations 500 years ago to 41,000 denominations now. 41,000 times we've said, we don't agree, so we can't be with you. And there's something about that that's very viscerally satisfying. And that's the thing that has to be changed. We have to be able to walk into an arena in which we can be in that non-agreement space and yet still love our neighbor, even love our enemy. The second part of the lesson will be about the kind of relationships that we need to work on changing systems. It's about moving beyond the trend that is happening in our society. Here's what's happening in our society. Our groups with the people that are like us are getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. We have to move beyond those shrinking circles and the idea that we can only be with and work with people who agree with us. And we have to break through the habituated demonizing that we do of the other. Because if the other doesn't think the way that we are, and it's especially true if the other is the way that we used to think ourselves, but now we've come to some enlightened state and we don't think that way anymore, we particularly demonize those people. And that's become so common now that it's just a habit. And the function is a shrinking, smaller and smaller version of us. So it's going to be a lesson rooted in what Jesus taught us, to love one another, to love the neighbor, to love the enemy, but also to make peace quickly with those with whom we have a divide. Even do it on the way to court, Jesus said. Because if you get there, even if you win, you're going to do so much damage to the relationship, it's going to affect you in the end because it's affecting the whole. Even if you win, you're destroying the environment that you live in. You've got to learn to do better than that. So, Jesus said, you can do this. You can work together and you can change the world, but you're going to have to be the kind of people who learn, discern, do the practices that help you do that. And then once we've done all of that, now we've got to learn how to make it here, now, small, doable. Service that we can actually do in our lives. Systems that change that we can actually do in our lives. Now, here's a sneak peek of the conclusion of the lesson. We can do that. It is doable. You can get there from here. Now, the pathway that's been laid out for us is an ancient one. And it has a lot to do with how we are becoming. But we can do this. You can get there from here. Our tradition insists that we can do it and still go to work. We can do it and still have time for our families. We can do it and still participate in the things that we participate in. We can do what our tradition insists we can do. We can change the world. And so, indwelling Spirit of God, may it be so. In our lives and in our own spiritual community, in this community of communities and in our city and county, may it be that we are participants in the changing of our world as we follow Jesus. Amen.
Here's a quick recap of the What Are You Thinking time we did following this lesson. And as we said, we'd love to hear what you're thinking too. Head on over to our community's Facebook page and post your thoughts. You can search Facebook for North Raleigh Community Church Downtown.
Right after the lesson, one of the first